Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Patrick Schmidt. How are you, Patrick?
Very well, thanks, Chris. Nice to meet you.
Perfect. You're the drinks business editor, which makes you quite an important person in the wine industry. But what is the drinks business?
Well, it was a magazine set up a bit over 10 years ago to deal with the commercial aspects of alcoholic drinks, dedicated to the trade, and it's been surprisingly very successful, and it's grown a lot since its launch. We now have a product for Hong Kong specifically called the Drinks Business Hong Kong.
Yep.
We have the Spirits Business as well, which is only international magazine dedicated just to spirits. And we have the drinksbusiness.com, which is now the most read trade website in the world for alcoholic drinks.
Oh, I go on there occasionally, but I didn't quite realize it was that popular.
Yeah, no, we've surprised ourselves.
Yeah. I was talking to your web guy. He was a bit surprised he was allowed out of the back rooms. I think yesterday I was talking to him and he was going, oh, they've put me in front of the stand here at the London International Wine Fair, and he wasn't quite sure why.
Oh, right, okay. Was that Lewis?
I think it was,
yeah. Okay, I know Lewis, yes. Yeah, we don't normally allow him out. He's a bit of a liability.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, so drinks business, focusing on drinks. So it's not just wines, it's beers and spirits.
Yeah.
Flicking through your magazine, it seems to be a lot of spirits and a lot of wine, not so much on the beer side. Is that just because I've not been reading enough of the articles on beer? Or
No, I think that's very well observed. We curtailed the beer coverage in the last year and a half because we were finding it difficult to crack that market. And commercially, it was also quite difficult to make it pay for the amount of work that goes into it. It's quite a high production values magazine. It's expensive to produce.
Yeah.
But we did launch a magazine called The Beer Business, but it was online only a few years ago. And we used to run it every month to a collection of email addresses that we had for the beer industry. But after about a year, we decided to scotch it. We didn't do it as well as I would have liked to have done it, in the sense that we didn't produce a magazine. We might revisit that and look at beer more closely. But we now do quite a lot of beer coverage online.
Oh, okay. Because the beer industry, you know, just because you're wine, beers and spirits, you know, the wine industry is quite interesting. There's quite a few big players with reasonably decent marketing budgets. The spirits industry's definitely got the marketing budget. Yeah. And the beer industry, I would have thought, has got the marketing budget as well, but perhaps there may be the products don't have the innovation.
I think we weren't reaching them, but we certainly have written a lot about the craft and microbrewery scene.
Yeah.
We find that when we write online anything to do with beer, we get a spike in hits. We've written quite a lot about wine beers, which I think are an interesting development that span a crossover. Well, they're a category of beers where sometimes they have flavors from particular grapes, or they use wine yeasts to produce the beer, and they're very unusual, but you get things like Chardonnay beers, Sauvignon Blanc beers, you get some sparkling beers using champagne yeasts.
Yeah.
And that's something that intrigues us and we've written about. Not many other magazines have written about that.
So Chardonnay beer, is it using flavors like Chardonnay flavors, like the hops to get the Chardonnay flavors, or has it actually got some grapes in it?
Some of them have grapes in them. Some of them use particular yeasts that are used more commonly for the fermenting grape must into wine.
Yeah. I've seen some of those.
And there are a range of products. I mean, there's a lot of innovation going on in beer.
Yeah.
A lot in spirits, less in wine because it's tightly controlled. And as you say, the budgets aren't often there to fund that sort of level of R&D.
I know there's loads of innovation going on in beer. I do the odd beer tasting and I've done all sorts of stuff on beer in the past, and particularly in America with all the hops and all that sort of stuff. Quite interesting. But we're a wine show. Let's get back onto the wine. So, I understand you started 10 years ago. It was originally, the owner came out from Harper's, was that right?
Yes, that's correct. The publisher, the owner, and some of the other staff came from Harper's Wine and Spirit. They'd felt there was a gap in the market for a high-quality magazine with all the kind of production values of a consumer magazine, but for the wine and spirits trade, and particularly focusing on branded drinks and the commercial aspects of the drinks trade. And that's why they launched the drinks business with almost a kind of Ron Seals type name.
I thought some of the articles that you've got in here are quite good articles.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm not sucking up to you in any way. If you ask anybody, I don't generally do that.
Okay.
I thought some of the wine stuff, I'm just trying to remember some of them now.
Did you see the stuff on celebrity wine packaging?
No, I did not see that. That wasn't. I saw an article on the beer production, Motorhead Beer.
Oh yes.
Which made me think a bit about that actually, because the beer producer was. You know, they're up to making as much as they can and they can't keep up with demand, which does make you think a bit about celebrity endorsements and things like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie and all that sort of stuff and their wines.
Yes, I think the Motorhead bag and box sort of designed to look like a portable music amplifier was one of the products that featured in that article. I was going to say the main crux of this issue that you're looking at was a survey that we do every year, trying to rate the 100 most powerful wines and spirits in the world.
Yeah, yes, I saw that. And wine doesn't show up particularly high, I think.
No,
it's. How do you manage wine? How do you judge the power level? Is it based on brand awareness? Is it based on marketing income, budgets?
Well, there are a number of measures, which is what makes the list quite unusual and unique to us. And we look at brand awareness. We look at a series of measures, some which are hard, some which are soft, as we say. So some are based on perception by the panelists, and some that are based on hard figures, such as performance data over the last 12 months.
Yep.
And growth. And then we look at historic data as well. So we look at things like heritage, which would be a soft measure. We look at things like awareness. We look at things like future growth and the share of the market, which are hard measures. And we add those all up, and then we times the results by a weighted volume figure. And that then gives you a score for power. And then we rank the brands according to power.
Okay, just looking at the wine brands in particular, I think wine came up quite weakly, actually, in terms of overall brands. And here we are. Whiskey came first, then vodka, rum, cane, sugar rum, flavored spirits. Still white wine was number 5, which is not very good, given that wine is such a volume product compared to spirits. I would have thought there'd be a lot more wine consumed in the UK than spirits, but
this is an international survey. The problem with wine is that there are very few truly global wine brands,
yeah.
If any, and it never scores as well as spirits.
Yeah.
There aren't the high price points. There aren't the high margins to reinvest in brand building. Yes, there are the volumes. I mean, a company like Gallo in total is probably doing 70 million cases of wine, but they don't have the scale. And quite often they don't have the distribution either. If you look at the most powerful brand in this survey, it's Johnnie Walker. Mm-hmm. And that's now doing 20 million cases. And a lot of that is 12-year-old Scotch. And it's a truly international brand with a consistent marketing message, whichever country it's sold, and the same packaging and slightly different variants, but it's the same product worldwide. It's extremely well known.
Yeah, no.
And that is a power brand. Unfortunately, in wine, if you look at some of the names there, they're often focused very strongly on one or two markets.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, if you think of the prices, I mean, Yellowtail has been a successful brand, but its average price is below $10 a bottle.
Yeah. And also, they're not profitable at the moment.
And they've obviously been hit by the currency issue and US market. And again, it's another case of a brand that's too strongly dependent on one major market.
Interesting. If you go through these, the most powerful wine brands, according to you guys, it's Gallo, Hardy's, Concertoro, Robert Mondavi, Yellowtail, Sutterholme, Lindemann's, Beringer, Jacob's Creek, Blossom Hill, Torres, Wolf Blass, Kendall, Jackson, Inglenook. Where's France?
Yeah, it's true. There's very little exposure from France.
Yeah, yeah. I would have thought things like Margaux or the top first growths would have had, you know, because they're very prestigious, very high value, and they do produce a shed load of product by relative terms. You'd think that maybe some of those would have come in.
They're very strong international brands, and they have awareness, but they're much too small. You know, we're looking at figures for all of those top names you listed of over 20 million cases. A brand like Lafite will produce 20,000 cases.
Yeah.
So it's an absolute fraction of what these guys are producing. We do another list in December, which is similar, which is the top 100 most powerful fine wine brands.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that.
And in that, you'll see that Lafite and the First Growths dominate. As do some of the right bank labels, and then certain other fine wine brands like Screaming Eagle always does well.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Now that makes sense. So, okay, so you do all sorts of drinks. You obviously do some stuff on wine, you do some stuff on that. Where's your distribution? Is it international or is it UK-centric?
We have a UK bias, but we're international. So about 60% goes to the UK trade. And then we're quite strong in Europe, continental Europe, Northern Europe. And then we go out to South Africa, Australia, mainly wine-producing countries that have a strong market share in the UK, read the drinks business. The only market and that we are quite weak on with the printed product is the USA, that's well served by consumer and trade wine and spirit press. But online, we have a lot of readership from the USA.
Okay, it's a bit like the Daily Mail, isn't it? It's one of the biggest read online newspapers in the world, and you wouldn't have thought so. But,
well, I mean, the Daily Mail is so addictive. I mean, they have the sort of the sidebar of shame, and once you start looking, you can't stop, and I think they've cracked it.
What sort of readership have you got? Are you willing to give us figures?
Well, our print run is up to 15,000 a month,
yep.
Which we do for big trade fairs, and then we hover around 11,000, 12,000 for the rest of the time.
Okay.
But that's just for the drinks business. Then we have another 6,000 to 7,000 copies that we produce every 2 months for the Hong Kong and Asian trade, mm-hmm. With the drinks business Hong Kong, so that we have a specific product for that market.
Okay. Do you recycle some of the content into
Chinese? About 40% gets recycled for the Hong Kong trade. When we launched, it was a lot less. But actually, the feedback from our partners out there was that they wanted to get access to a lot of the information and articles that you find in the European wine press, and they wanted it out there in Hong Kong as well.
Okay, well, that's quite good circulation, though, isn't it? But it's how does that compare to Harper's? Because Harper's is a bit lower these days, aren't they?
I don't know what the figures are for Harper's. I mean, Harper's is very much for the UK trade,
yeah.
Whereas we're international. We're on and off trade, which is the case for Harper's. What I would say is the most important thing is making sure that you're going to the most influential people in the trade and that they respect your publication and they read you.
Yeah.
And we know that's the case. But I mean, if you were to look at the most powerful wine buyers for UK retail, I could probably give you a list of about 200 names that would make up over 95% of sales in the UK. So to know that you're going to them and that they're reading what you have to say and they're following your title is really important.
Yep.
So it's not always about numbers, it's about being targeted. I mean, if you look at the duty-free sector, it's very consolidated. They're just a few buyers that count for a very large share of sales for wine and spirits. And to make sure that you go to those sorts of names is what's important, rather than printing lots of very expensive magazines and sending them around the world to people who are interested. And obviously, it's important to get subscribers, but aren't necessarily massively influential when it comes to shifting volumes of wine.
And then I suppose you make your money mainly from the advertising, is it?
Advertising and subscription. And I mean, publishing is tough. It's very hard to make money.
Yeah.
So it's important to do awards and events as well to supplement the income.
That's right. You've announced your awards, haven't you?
Yeah.
You don't do awards for like best Chardonnay or anything like that. It's more awards for the industry.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because we're just at the fair launching
the best award for the best Chardonnay.
For the best Chardonnay. So I think you should,
work for
that large team of strategists we have at the drinks business. We do awards for the trade, and we do personality awards, and those are what the Drinks Business Awards have been about. This year was our 10th year we've held those.
Yep.
And they've been very well received, and we enjoy doing them. But we also actually have found that we do quite good events, and we enjoy them. And we also run a master's series for spirits that we do through the spirits business that rewards products according to their quality. And that's used to experience panel of tasters. And we're just launching those for wines by variety.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to do the Chardonnay
master. Not by country.
So my feeling is that a lot of people get pigeonholed into different countries. And from that, people draw various preconceptions about what the style of the wine is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very true with Chardonnay. What we're going to do is we're going to take in entries, starting with Chardonnay, The wines will be judged by price band and nothing else, blind.
Yep.
By the sort of USP for the competition will be that they'll be judged only by master sommeliers or masters of wine. And it'll be judged at the Institute of Master of Wine because we're media partners with the Institute of Master of Wine. So it'll be judged by very high quality judges who know what they're talking about. And it'll be looking at just the variety, and you won't be judged within a country category, but you'll be judged against your competitors by organized by price.
Oh, that's quite interesting, isn't it? That is quite a deviation from the way most competitions are judged by country and then region as well, which is quite nice, actually. Well, the classic one I'm thinking of is sparkling wine. Any competition I know where champagne competes against non-champagne sparkling wines is the Bonaccino di Mondo competition. And I think that's brilliant because you get to see how they're actually stacking up. So you don't normally see that because no one wants to actually be competing against, you know, Burgundy doesn't want to be competing against New Zealand Pinot Noir because New Zealand Pinot Noir is so good. Just offended half the listeners there. But because, you know, they don't want to be seen. If you've already got a very strong, prestigious position, the last thing you want is actually be beaten by someone who's maybe not quite as prestigious.
Well, I mean, there are brands out there that have more to lose possibly than to gain. I mean, if you entered, I don't know, a Pinot Noir from Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, and it lost out to, I don't know, Atarangi in Martinborough in New Zealand, then they'd have a lot to lose, and Atarangi would have a hell of a lot to gain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there are a lot of people out there that do have a point to prove. We might find, as a result of the competition, that, I don't know, a Premier Grand Cru Pouligny-Montrachet wins Best Chardonnay over £30. Equally, we might find it's a Yarra Valley skinny Chardonnay from Australia. So who knows? But I do know from the studying that I do and the amount of blind tasting I do that when you get very experienced people in a room, quite often they confuse very good New World Chardonnay with top white Burgundy. And people at the end of those tastings think they've got it wrong because they're not good tasters. Actually, they're good tasters. It's just that Australia and California and some other places, New Zealand as well, and yesterday I had some very good Chardonnay from the Finger Lakes, New York State. They're parts of the New World that are producing very high quality wines that do compete, and therefore we want to pitch them against the classics.
Will you find that maybe some of the people with the brands or and the recognition already just won't compete?
Looking at some of the entries, people are willing to take part. Okay, so some of the French are always suspicious of competitions because I think they assume that everyone cheats. Maybe that's unfair. But the range of entries so far is truly international, and we will target people. You know, we're not just expecting people to come to us.
What about the other awards that you have, mainly for the drinks industry? What sort of awards did you announce today?
Well, today we had we always do a Man and Woman of the Year. Our Man of the Year was Jay Wright, who's Managing Director of Virgin Wines.
Oh, yeah.
And has really turned around that business. He's only 42. It was a very strong entry. Then our Woman of the Year was Laura Jewell, MW, who's one of the wine buyers at Tesco. She's also the first ever female chairman of the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Very highly regarded. She's a Master of Wine. She's used to be a Master of Wine Examiner. And then we had awards for packaging. A very interesting little wine brand won the best packaging for wine this year. It was designed by Barlow Doherty. And it was a wine brand conceived and designed to be only served in 187 milliliters. So only small formats for bars and pubs. And therefore it had this little label with a life-size small animal on it and a little ruler down the size to show the measurements. And I thought it was a very nice solution for quite a specific brief. But it's things like that.
Yeah, I tell you what though, that unit size, we ask our listeners every now and then what's their preferred unit size, or not unit size, but glass size. And 175 mil is the one that everybody likes.
Right.
The bars always want to serve 250 and give you a small option, but it's the 175 mil that's the one that everybody wants, which is, a lot of people just sort of skip that, you know. And if you go to a pub, small glass, large glass, medium glass doesn't really get a chance in.
Yes, I mean, you get those sort of buckets of wine, don't you, in pubs. And if it's white wine, unless you drink it very quickly, it's warm by the time you get to the bottom. If it's red wine, it just, I don't know, it feels a bit oversized.
Yeah.
They say that it offers value, and sometimes if you buy two glasses, you get the rest of the bottle free, because two glasses of 250 ml, you've already drunk two-thirds of the bottle.
Two-thirds of the bottle, exactly.
Anyway, so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if the glass size is to blame for drinking too much.
Oh, no, but, I'm not talking about the volume, about consumption. I'm saying that what people prefer is the 175ml glass, whether they want it because they think it's good value or whatever. Yeah. But if you ask people, what's your preferred glass size, they go for the 175. And a lot of pubs just don't serve that.
Yeah.
They'll serve a 250 and they'll serve 125.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's about 50% of people prefer the 175ml. Do a survey next time.
Yeah, we should do. We should do a poll online.
Yeah, do it, and you'll find. We do it. We ask. We ask people at our tastings, and that's the one that everybody likes. And you never can get one, or you can, but they're not the common measure, which is strange.
Maybe they don't make the margins on 175 that they do.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's a good commercial reason for it.
No, well, I don't know what it is. Yeah. I think what's nice is to have a small measure in quite a large glass.
Yeah, yeah. I think.
But then people feel ripped off if they see that in a pub.
Yeah, I know. I want a 175 and a 250ml glass. Yeah. And I'm happy camper.
Yeah.
What's the biggest innovation you've seen sort of in the drinks off or off on trade recently from a wine perspective?
What, in terms of retailing of wine?
Yeah, retail or wholesale. Okay. Retail.
Well, something that just won an award in our own awards today was the Morrison's Taste Test.
Oh, yeah.
Which the wine trade, when it was, basically it works by you go into the store or you do it online. And you're asked various questions about your taste in hot drinks, coffee, chocolates, soft drinks, and a few other parameters. And then from that, they make a judgment of what sort of wine you like, whether it's delicate or rich or oaky or whatever.
Yeah.
And when it was launched, the trade were quite rude about it because it kind of didn't work for them. And it doesn't work for wine experts. You know, if you analyze it too closely, I mean, I'm quite happy. I'd rather drink Coke than Diet Coke, but I like my coffee black without sugar. So I probably confuse it a little bit, but if you're looking at people with no wine knowledge, it's a really clever in-store method to simplify choosing wine without resorting to just price promotion.
Yep.
So I think it should be applauded.
Yeah, I actually been doing my own survey on that. I used the Morrison's Taste Test. Because we sit down with people and we've been doing papillae counting, looking at people's papillae, and then doing the Morrison's Taste Test, and then the prop test as well, which is another way of measuring people's taste. And we've been doing surveys about what they like and dislike. And there are some quite strong correlations with some of the wines and less so with others. So there is some value to it. And I think you're right about the trade, because it's checking your nature, not your nurture. And the wine trade, we just get thrown so many wines. Eventually, we sort of move away from our underlying nature to what we see so much stuff, you end up enjoying all sorts of wines, whereas the public who are maybe just drinking more pigeonhole wines, they know what they like. It gives them an opportunity to explore around that range with more confidence, which is quite nice.
Mm.
Yeah, no, I like it. All right then, Patrick. I think we better let you get back to what you were doing. But thanks very much for your time.
Nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Cheers, bud.